Among the rolling downland and the forests of the Meuse Argonne is a hillside with more than 14,000 crosses. Here, the doughboys, the dead of the American Expeditionary Force in those final weeks of the conflicts on the Western Front, here we find them buried in the Meuse Argonne American Cemetery. America entered the Great War in April 1917 and brought with it a vast but untrained army. Just like the formation of the new army, Kitchener's Army, in 1914, it took time for the American Expeditionary Force, those units that would cross to France and take part in the final battles on the Western Front, it took time for them to be trained. But by that spring of 1918, it was only a matter of months, perhaps even weeks, before the vast majority of those combat units were ready to be committed to the battlefields. And the Germans knew that as much as the Allies, which resulted in those German offensives of 1918, some of which involved American units. But the bulk of the American Expeditionary Force would not take part in major actions until the beginning of the Meuse-Argonne Offensive in September of 1918, when General Blackjack Pershing's troops launched America's biggest offensive, took part in America's biggest battle since the American Civil War, a generation or more before. And in this episode, we find ourselves on those Meuse-Argonne battlefields of those final weeks of the conflict on the Western Front. When we think of the Meuse Argonne, we think of the Argonne Forest, this vast area of forested ground. And there are many stories associated with the American troops in that offensive that take place in those forested battlefields. But it wasn't all forest. And here we are on open downland. There is woodland here. We can look around us. We're south of a small village, and we're looking up to rising ground, part of that downland ahead of us, which the village sits on, and beyond that rising ground again, where there is some wooded areas. So it's more wooded than Flanders or the Somme, but it's very similar terrain. And the Germans had fortified this entire position with an in-depth system of defences and extended the Hindenburg line down to here, and sections of that famous Hindenburg line ran right through the battlefields where we are now. We're on a small road near one of those areas of woodland, the Bois de Cunel. And here we're standing right by that system of Hindenburg line defences. Now, the original Hindenburg line had been dug in that winter of 1916-17 on the British sector, down towards Soissons in the French sector, with a massive system of trenches that were wide and deep, with bunkers and concreted positions and thick belts of wire. And when the extension of the Hindenburg line was made in 1918 into this sector, it was no different. Those trenches were incredibly deep, had very good fields of fire, well sighted, and were perfect defensive lines. And it was this kind of battlefield that the troops of the American Expeditionary Force, the AEF, fought their first great battles of the First World War. Now, where we are was the scene of very heavy fighting in this advance from the area of the woodland that we're close to, with the village on the rising ground ahead of us. This was a battlefield of October 1918, so some days into the Meuse-Argonne offensive, and the American 3rd and 80th Divisions fought in this sector. Divisions within the American Army in the Great War were probably even more important than those for the British Army. Soldiers identified with their division, particularly with National Guard units, which were often recruited from particular areas. There was a kind of sense of almost them being POWs or territorial troops. This was the equivalent, America's equivalent of the Territorial Army, the National Guard. Not every unit had a local affiliation, but soldiers were proud of the division that they fought with. They wore a cloth patch on their uniforms that had the insignia of the division. Many soldiers painted that on their helmets, particularly later in the war or when the war was over. You often see these painted American helmets from that period come up for sale on online auctions or Militaria dealers. So there was a great identification with Division, and you see this in the records of American soldiers. It's noted, for example, on all of their graves. But walking down this road that we're on, getting a sense of the terrain and how the rises in ground here, defended by the Germans, gave them perfect positions to try and throw the Americans back. This was no easy battle. America had entered the fray in the last few weeks, had in many respects not entirely learnt the lessons from those who tutored them in their preparation and training, which was largely British forces. War-weary as they were able to pass on some of their knowledge. Not all of that was taken on board, and in those opening weeks of the Meuse-Argonne offensive, the AEF under Pershing learnt a lot of lessons very quickly, but often pretty costly lessons as well. And the village that is ahead of us is the small village of Cunel. It took a week of fighting in 1918 to move from the edge of the wood where we've started up into the village of Cunel and the woods on the high ground beyond. And it cost thousands of American lives. Unit after unit went through here, and the village of Cunel changed hands on many occasions in October 1918. The US forces would make their attack, elements of units would capture the village or parts of it, and the Germans would counterattack and throw them back. And the fight here to'd and fro'd until eventually the wooded area beyond and the village was captured. Four different American divisions fought in this area at that time. And really, Cunel became a kind of microcosm of the tough fighting in this part of the Meuse-Argonne battlefield. It came to symbolise so much of what American troops went through in that final phase of the Great War, but for them, the early phase of their combat experiences. When we look at the fighting in and around Cunel, one action for me kind of typifies the experience of those American troops, the Doughboys, the Sammies, as the French called them after Uncle Sam. And that is the action involving Lieutenant Sam Woodfill of the 60th Infantry. Sam was from Indiana, and he was the son of a Civil War veteran. He joined the army as a private, and he'd served in Mexico before America had entered the Great War. There's a fantastic quote about his action here in 1918 from an excellent book that was published in the lead-up to the outbreak of the Second World War, which is The American Armies and Battlefields in Europe. Now, this was a guidebook to all the places where the AEF had fought on the Western Front, and it was published in the late 30s, just a couple of years before the Second World War broke out, and I would guess that very, very few American visitors ever put that guidebook to use because of what was just round the corner. So it didn't sell very well, and copies were available for many, many years afterwards quite cheaply. Original copies are much more expensive now, but you can download a PDF of it for free from the American Battlefield Monuments Commission website, and we'll put a link to them on the podcast website. It's a great guidebook. I mean, the maps in it are superb. There's excellent photographs and tons of information. And they describe Lieutenant Sam Woodfill's action from the point in Cunel Village, which they recommend you to go to as part of the tour that they describe in the book. And they describe it this way. Lieutenant Woodfill was leading his company in an attack towards the Bois de la Putière from the small wooded areas to the left of here when it encountered heavy enemy fire. Followed at some distance by two soldiers, he immediately advanced towards a machine gun nest, which was at the edge of the wood in the rear of here, and worked his way round its flank. Four of the enemy emerged, three of whom were shot by Lieutenant Woodfill, and the fourth, an officer, was killed in hand-to-hand combat. The company then continued to advance through the wood until another enemy machine gun nest was encountered. Again, Lieutenant Woodfill rushed ahead of his command in the face of heavy fire from the nest, and when several of the enemy appeared, he shot them, captured three other members of the crew, and silenced the gun. A few minutes later, this officer for the third time demonstrated conspicuous bravery by charging another machine gun position and by employing in turn a rifle, a pistol, and finally a pick, killed seven of the enemy. General Pershing praised Woodfill as one of the outstanding soldiers of the American Expeditionary Force. He was gassed in this action, and that ended his military career on the battlefield, although he survived the war. for his bravery here in the Meuse-Argonne offensive, he was awarded the Medal of Honour, and when he died, he was buried in Arlington Military Cemetery. In Cunel village, where we are now, close to the church, it's only a small village with a handful of houses completely destroyed in the 1918 battles, although one or two of the buildings look to me as if they have some original features. There's a marble wall next to the church, which looks like an old watering trough for cattle, inscribed with the names of three Americans from Boston who died for freedom, as the American memorial states. They were all students at Harvard University College, and their names were Robert Fitzgerald Clark, who was an ensign in the US Aviation Forces, killed on the 21st of August 1918, Charles Henry Fisk III, who was a second lieutenant in the 111th Infantry, 28th Division, killed on the 24th of August 1918, and Aaron David Wild, first lieutenant of the 7th Infantry, 3rd US Division, killed on the 11th of October 1918, in Cunel, where we are now, and he is the only one who has a direct connection to this location. The memorial is a bit of a mystery, really, because the other two died in other sectors where the AEF were fighting, not here at Cunel, and Wild is buried nearby. It's unclear who actually placed this memorial here. There's very little about it in the American Battlefields book, and I can find almost nothing about its history online. So if anyone listening knows more about this memorial, I'd certainly be interested to hear myself. When we leave Cunel, we go out through the western side of the village. It comes out into some open ground. We've got rising ground to our right, where the positions of the German defences were located. We can look back towards that wooded area where we started, and we can see the potential fields of fire. The road dips down and we can see some very distinct trees lining an area ahead of us and some white marble of a big monument. And that brings us to the entrance of the Meuse-Argonne American Cemetery, our next stop. As we approach from Cunel with the village behind us, we see this large marble stone structure ahead of us with an American eagle at the top of it and announcing that we'd have arrived at the Meuse-Argonne American Cemetery. We have looked at this cemetery briefly in a previous podcast where we looked at five lesser-known cemeteries of the Great War. You can go back through the podcast catalogue to find that. But it's about time that we did this properly, and that's what we're going to do in this episode. As we walk in, everything really begins immediately to appear big. That is the whole kind of purpose of American cemeteries from both World Wars. And they're here really to memorialize a generation of Americans who came over to fight for freedom. America wanted the world to know what it had achieved in this conflict, and again with its efforts in the Second World War. So these cemeteries are always on a big scale, because this was, in the Great War, America's first time in combat, first time in conflict outside of America itself, with the exception of the wars against Mexico. But the Civil War, the American Civil War, had been America's last big conflict, a devastating conflict that had ruptured America and caused such horrific casualties as a result of all the fighting. And this conflict, with American troops finally entering the fray in those final battles of 1918, would also see more than 50,000 combat dead in those final weeks. Now, that is nothing approaching the kind of casualties of the British and Commonwealth forces in 4 years on the Western Front, but it's not an insignificant amount of dead, and something that it really is important to remember. And as we come into the cemetery, we can see a main road running through towards a large pool of reflection ahead of us, a road going off to our right, which we're going to follow, that would take us up and outside what was originally the keeper's lodge, the kind of warden's house. And we'll come to that in a minute. But as we pause at the entrance to that and look to our left, we look down across that pool of reflection out towards the vast mass of graves that make up this cemetery. And it's an amazing, moving scene that's ahead of us, this hillside covered in white crosses. Whenever I come here, with groups, for example, people often say, is this where they film the closing scene of Oh, What a Lovely War? Now, in Oh, What a Lovely War, that 1960s film based on the play about the tragedy and the cost of the Great War, which characterised, I think, a kind of popular opinion of the First World War as a useless slaughter. I mean, that's another podcast discussing that in its own right. But the end of that film sees Sir John Mills as Douglas Haig standing by some white crosses, and then it pans out to show this entire hillside of white crosses. That was actually made especially for the film. Those crosses were planted by Brighton dustmen on the South Downs above Brighton, where much of the filming took place. And the cemetery, a vast cemetery of white crosses, was created for that final scene. So it isn't filmed here, but that's what it looks like. And that is a common reaction that British visitors have when they come here. For me, I think it's really always made such an impression on me, the cost that America paid in this conflict. And when you go to the cemeteries of the Second World War, not far from here is the Lorraine American Cemetery with the graves from World War II, the final months of the Second World War. And it's a cemetery not as big as this one, because this is the largest American cemetery in Europe. Nevertheless, that is the largest Second World War American cemetery in Europe. And we can see the costs of sacrifice and the cost of freedom when you go there. An American Second World War veteran that I had the honour to meet during some filming some years ago, Ed Shames, always said that the price of freedom, there's a cost, and the cost of the lives of men like this. And that's something that for the Great War that you see very vividly when you stand on this spot and look across to that hillside of white crosses. The information centre that is now in what was once the Keeper's Lodge, which essentially still is, the admin staff are in here. And in all my years of coming here, I first came here in 1987, they've always been really, really helpful. And when we made Last Day of World War I with Michael Palin in 2008, they were especially helpful for finding graves of 11th of November casualties that were in here, and quite a few other things besides. Now, it's not just an information point where you can go and ask to find where a burial is. There's a little visitor centre in there as well that tells the stories of many of those buried in the cemetery, and Medal of Honor winners, and all kinds of other aspects. And these are now prominent at all American cemeteries from the two world wars, and are really welcome because they help interpret what we see. But as we walk down from that visitor centre, down the slope and up towards the first plot of graves, we're looking at the Meuse-Argonne American Cemetery. It stands on a hillside with graves of more than 14,000 American soldiers whose final resting place is here, having been killed in that final weeks of the Great War. As the American Battlefields guidebook says, there can be no more fitting site that could have been chosen for these battle dead than the gentle slopes of the valley joining Cunelle and Romagna, where the deeds of daring, devotion and heroism were unsurpassed. So what we've got here is more than 14,200 soldiers buried on this hillside in 8 plots. Most of the dead that are buried here fell in the operations of the American Expeditionary Force from the 26th of September 1918, the opening day of the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, and the 11th of November, the last day of the Great War here on the Western Front. Of these 14,200 burials, 486 are unknown soldiers. In 1922, when the cemetery was begun, when the final resting place of these men was chosen, initially they'd been buried in different battlefield sites right across the area where the American forces had been fighting. The casualties from a wide area were brought in here for burial. Men from the Vosges Mountains, where the Americans had held the line down there, from the area on the other side of the Argonne Forest into the Champagne, where some of the US Marine Corps units had been fighting, for example, and also men from occupied Germany. There was a sense in America in both World Wars that they didn't want their men, their soldiers, to be buried on enemy soil. I remember reading a document about World War II when they began the construction of American cemeteries post-Second World War, that one American officer said he didn't want the dead to be buried on Nazi soil. So all of them were removed from burial sites within Germany and brought to cemeteries like Lorraine, the American cemetery that we mentioned previously. But here for the First World War, that kind of policy began. So the dead that had been buried in Germany, because American forces were part of the occupation forces of Germany just after the war, and Americans had died there as prisoners of war, they were exhumed and brought for burial here. There were also men who had died as part of the Russian Expeditionary Force. So the Allies sent troops to fight alongside the White Russians against the Bolshevik Revolution at the end of the First World War. And Americans who were killed there were also moved to this place for burial if they were not repatriated. Almost every unit of the American Expeditionary Force is represented by one or more burials in this cemetery. So how were the American dead then buried? We're only looking at a fraction, something like 62% of the dead were repatriated, and that's a very similar percentage for both world wars. America decided that as this was their first foray into a foreign war, that they would give the families the choice as to whether the dead remained buried on foreign soil or were brought home at the cost of the US taxpayer. So families didn't have to pay anything if they wanted their son, their brother, their husband to be brought back to be buried in a family grave and wherever that was in the US, or be buried in one of the military cemeteries like Arlington. So what happened after the war is all those smaller burial sites, and there would have been some around the village of Cunel, where we've just come from, were closed and the bodies were exhumed and then brought in here for burial. The Michelin Battlefield Guidebooks, there were three volumes of those in English published about the American battlefields of the First World War. They're fantastic little books. A lot of the information out of date or incorrect, but they still are fascinating documents about visiting those battlefields immediately after the war. They state that something like 28,000 graves were originally on this site. Now, that could be a slight confusion with the dead of the Meuse-Argonne offensive, but that probably sounds about right given how many were repatriated. So the Michelin guidebooks quoted that kind of figure for some time in the early 1920s, and then a process began where families made that decision, repatriation or reburial in the cemetery itself, and then the work to do that began. And the American Battlefield Monuments Commission had soldiers exhumed and then taken back by ship to America to be sent home to their families. Now, that would have, if there were 28,000 graves here and half that number were removed, there would have been big gaps in the plots, and it would have looked strange if they'd have just replaced those original grave markers with the marble crosses or Stars of David. So an architect was then appointed, and they redesigned the cemetery into these eight plots, and that then meant that the soldiers were exhumed again and moved. So when we look at the graves that remain here today, these men have been buried three times, once on the battlefield, then again when their remains were moved from a battlefield burial to here, and then again when they were moved for reburial to make the final design of the cemetery. And each time, and this is the kind of morbid side of it, the gruesome side of it, the grave registration troops who were doing this work had to ensure that they were reburying the right person. So the coffin that they were buried in had to be opened and searched for identity discs, dog tags, to confirm that this was this private, this officer, this soldier, whoever it was. So that work went on right into the 1920s, and the cemetery was finished by about 1931, and then some years later it was officially dedicated. It's a massive, massive site, well over 100 acres, and the wall round it alone is 1.5 miles long. It's a battlefield as well as a cemetery site, so the main Hindenburg line ran through the rear of the cemetery close to where the memorial chapel is located, and it sits in a position that is about 10 miles from the original jump-off positions of American troops on the first day of the Meuse-Argonne offensive on the 26th of September 1918. Like the fighting at Cunel down the road, the 3rd and 5th US divisions were very prominent and crucial in the capture of this ground in October of 1918. So as I said, the cemetery is not just a burial site, not just a military cemetery, it is a battlefield as well. There was fighting on this spot, men died on this spot, there were trench positions on this spot, and it was all fought over. So it's got kind of greater symbolism as just being the resting place of soldiers. It is part of those soldiers' stories, part of their old front line, if you like. And when we look at the kind of casualty figures, we can get a sense of the bitterness of the fighting in that Meuse-Argonne offensive, because there were 27,000 casualties suffered by the American 3rd, 4th, 5th, 32nd, 80th, 89th, 90th Divisions in the general vicinity of this cemetery. So that's a whole number of different American units, and together within the vicinity, within the kind of reach of this cemetery, in the wider area around it, they suffered over 27,000 casualties. So it shows that the battle that took place here in September and October of 1918, as they pushed up towards the Meuse River, was a tough fight and a defining moment in America's experience in the Great War. To the rear of the cemetery, beyond the plots of graves, is a memorial chapel that forms a memorial to the missing. Now, the American forces had missing soldiers that were missing in action in the same way that other nations did. Britain commemorated their missing on big memorials like the Menin Gate or Thiepval. France decided not to commemorate their dead, their missing dead, on memorials to the missing. Instead, they would be commemorated on local war memorials, so there's no equivalent of that for them. But America decided to follow the kind of British pattern, and in all of their cemeteries there is a chapel that commemorates the missing. So here, this one commemorates 954 names of those who were missing on the Western Front in this sector of the battlefields covered by the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery. Other American cemeteries commemorate the missing from those sectors, but also here the missing from Russia. Now, there are all kinds of circumstances in which soldiers go missing. For example, on the last day of the First World War, they were attacking across the Meuse River, and from combat reports that I've read when we prepared our research for the last day of World War I, men fell into that river and their bodies were lost, so their remains were never recovered. It wasn't quite the same kind of experience for American troops as, say, for the British and Canadians and Australians and others at Passchendaele, where men disappeared into the mud, but there were battlefield burials where men had been buried in trenches or shell craters, and artillery fire had smashed those graves up, and they couldn't be identified or were lost after the war. So the remains of soldiers, American soldiers, are still recovered from First World War battlefields, not on the same kind of scale, but they are still recovered in the same way they are of those from other nations. The memorial loggia that forms the memorial chapel displays the badges of all of the US divisions. Now, we mentioned how important the kind of symbolism of your division and its insignia was, and we see that demonstrated in the stained glass windows within this memorial chapel. And there's a map room area that has maps that show the course of the battle of the Meuse-Argonne offensive. These map rooms are, again, very common in all of the American cemeteries from the two world wars and are very, very impressive. And when you look along the ranks and the names and the units of the men who are listed on this memorial as missing in action, against some of them you see a little bronze rosette. And these mark the soldiers whose remains have been found since the construction of this memorial. Now, as we've said, the remains of American soldiers are still found. Last year, there was a report of the discovery of American soldiers during some construction work. And I remember there was a BBC Time Watch some years ago that looked at the work of the American recovery unit that goes out to recover American servicemen's bodies from battlefields right across the world from multiple conflicts, where they discovered the remains of some soldiers that were found during the construction of the Paris to Strasbourg railway line. And using the American records, they were able to identify these men. So they were, I think in their case, repatriated back to the United States. But here on this memorial to the missing, where they were listed, that little bronze rosette was placed against their name to indicate that they had been found. And when I see this, I sometimes wish that perhaps that's a practice that we would do on our great memorials, the British and Commonwealth memorials from the First World War. It would show just how many men had been subsequently recovered. There are so many fascinating stories. When we walk into these eight plots and we stand here and look at these more than 14,000 graves, it is a bit overwhelming. Where do you even begin? And when you begin to research these men, you find story after story. So where do we begin? Well, when we walk amongst the rows of crosses and stars of David in this cemetery, we can trace really through those burials the first moments of the Meuse-Argonne offensive in September 1918, when those units went over the top and there are men buried here who were killed in the first seconds of that battle as American troops left their trenches and went into action in no man's land. We can follow the tough fighting at places like Montfaucon, where they advanced up the slopes of the hill there, got into the village and fought their way across that ground. We can find men from the assaults in the open, vast open fields of the Champagne and the American attack on the Blancmont at Sompy. And we can find men, for example, from famous stories of the Great War, American stories, men from the Lost Battalion who disappeared in the Argonne Forest. That's been immortalised in books and most recently in film. There are men from the Harlem Hellfighters, American black soldiers who fought in combat. I remember many years ago watching Roots, which covered the story of black soldiers in the American forces and the prejudice that they faced, and when they were attached to the French forces, how they were put into combat and fought bravely in those battles of September, October, November of 1918. And we'll find their graves here too. And we can bring it right up to the end of the conflict, because there are graves, as we discovered when we did our research for Last Day of World War I, there are men buried here who were killed in the last moments of the Great War in the attacks along the Meuse River as American troops kind of moved up towards that final area of fighting, and also those who were killed in the fighting just north of Verdun. Verdun became an American battlefield in 1918, and the last American soldier to be killed was killed 1 minute before 11 o'clock on the 11th of November 1918 in the fighting there. He's not buried in this cemetery. He was one of that 62% that was repatriated back to America in the Great War. But there is quite a number of men whose crosses here bear the date 11th of November 1918. When we look at the burials, and when you go onto the American Battlefield Monuments Commission website, you can download a list of all the burials that are in here. And you can use that to do a bit of research in the same way you can do this with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website. It's a really useful thing to be able to do, and all credit to them to add this feature to their website as well. So when you look at this and kind of interrogate that data, you find that there's every rank amongst the burials here, amongst more than 14,000 burials, there's every rank from private to colonel. In fact, there's one colonel buried here, five lieutenant colonels, one regimental sergeant major, and five chaplains and a doctor. There's also women buried in the cemetery. There are four nurses whose graves are found here from the American Nursing Service. They died in September or October of 1918, either in base or evacuation hospitals that were just behind the front. So it kind of, already you can see by this, it covers a big kind of strata of the American experience of the First World War. And tragically as well, when you look at these records, you find that there are 22 pairs of brothers in this cemetery, many of them, but not all of them, but many of them buried side by side. In terms of gallantry, there's all of the American decorations that could be awarded for bravery on the battlefield found on the burials that are within this cemetery, and quite a few foreign decorations as well. Britain awarded medals to American soldiers. France did as well. So you see the Croix de Guerre and the Médaille Militaire also being awarded to soldiers of the American Expeditionary Force. And America's top award, their highest distinction for gallantry, is the Medal of Honor. It's the American equivalent of the Victoria Cross. And there are 9 Medal of Honor recipients buried in this cemetery. From Frank Luke, the American balloon buster, who had 13 kills shooting down enemy balloons, the key observation balloons that could do so much damage and direct their artillery fire. He was an ace as a consequence of this. To take on that many kills, this qualified him as an ace, one of a number of American aces who flew in that final phase of the First World War. He was shot down at Dun-sur-Meuse, and despite fatal injuries in that crash, carried on fighting with his Colt revolver until he died of his wounds. And then at the other extreme, you've got kind of an ace flying in the air. On the ground, you've got Freddie Stowers of the 371st Infantry, who carried out brave deeds at Cope 188 in September 1918, leading to his death on the battlefield. Now, he was one of a large number of black American soldiers whose bravery was not recognised by America. They were awarded gallantry medals by the French, but no black soldier was awarded the Medal of Honour in the Great War. And in the late 1980s, a campaign began that petitioned for a retrospective look at American history from the Civil War, I think right up to Vietnam, looking at the bravery of black American soldiers and recognising them with the retrospective award of the Medal of Honour. And Freddie Stouts was one of those whose bravery was deemed to be of the highest kind of level to be awarded this medal. So his Medal of Honour was officially declared, officially announced in 1991. And his headstone here was changed because Medal of Honour winners in American cemeteries, the inscription on their graves is picked out in gold lettering, so they stand out. And you can come into the cemetery and you can see them as you walk around the different plots. So if we'd have come here before 91, then Freddie Stouts' grave would not have had any mention of the Medal of Honour, would not been picked out in gold lettering, but now it is because finally his bravery has been recognised. And like I often say on this podcast, I kind of feel as if this is another example of the last page of the history of the Great War not being turned. It kind of keeps going on because there's always kind of new angles to this. And it's right and proper that the bravery of these black American soldiers who gave just as much step forward, fought for freedom and democracy, that their contribution to this conflict is properly recognised. There are United States Marine Corps casualties buried in this cemetery. US Marine Corps, I think because of the experience of World War II and their war in the Pacific, kind of maybe a lot of people don't realise that they fought in Europe. Belleau Wood, 1918, is of course one of their finest moments in their entire history of the Corps. But that's another battlefield where there is another American cemetery. But they fought here in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive and took part in operations in the Champagne near to Saint-Pie. And prior to that, had fought in quite a few other battles besides. And amongst the burials that are here is Maciej Kokak, who was an Austrian-born Marine of Slavic ancestry, who was awarded the Medal of Honour for his bravery near Soissons in July 1918 and killed on the 4th of October that year in the attack on the Blancmont Ridge in the Champagne. His citation for the Medal of Honour gives us a kind of sense of American combat experience in the Great War. For extraordinary heroism while serving with the 66th Company, 5th Marine Regiment, 2nd Division, in action at the Villers-Cotterets section south of Soissons, France, 18th July 1918, when a hidden machine gun nest halted the advance of his battalion, Sergeant Kokak went forward alone, unprotected by covering fire, and worked his way in between the German positions in the face of heavy enemy fire. Rushing the enemy position with his bayonet, he drove off the crew. Later the same day, he organised 25 French colonial soldiers who had become separated from their company and led them in an attack on another machine gun nest, which was also put out of action. So he got the Medal of Honour, was awarded the Medal of Honour for that action in July 1918 during the Second Battle of the Marne, that critical moment in which the final phase of the German offensive was stopped and the Allies began really that moment pushing the Germans back, leading to the end of the war in November 1918. And then he was killed in the Marine Corps' penultimate major action of the Great War in the Champagne. After that, they moved up towards the Meuse River, and they were one of the units crossing the Meuse on footbridges, coming under enemy fire from the banks beyond on that final day of World War I. Like I say, there's a lot of individual stories here, and we could fill podcast after podcast with them, but another one that I wanted to mention was Victor Chapman. He was born in New York City in 1890, and he was one of many Americans who crossed to France at the beginning of the Great War, or already were in France, who were kind of outraged that America had not entered the war against Germany at that point. So they joined the Légion Étrangère, the French Foreign Legion. And he served in the ranks of that unit in the early battles in Artois, in the Champagne, with fellow Americans like Alan Seeger, who became a major poet of the Great War and was killed on the Somme in 1916. Victor Chapman then later underwent pilot training and transferred to the Lafayette Escadrille, the American squadron that fought with the French Air Force in the Great War, and has been immortalised in books and again in films. And there's a whole collection of Victor Chapman's letters from the First World War that have been reprinted, and I'll put a link to that on the podcast website. He was shot down not during the American battles of the Great War. He became the first American aviator to be killed in battle in the Great War, fighting for the French in the Battle of Verdun. He was shot down near Douaumont on the 24th of June 1916. So this is long before America had even entered the war. And there were a lot of American citizens killed fighting with the French Foreign Legion in some of those early battles, like I say, of Artois, Champagne and other places besides. So it's an important grave in that respect. And there are several other men buried in here who died not with the American Expeditionary Force, but did die with French forces. And that's what's inscribed on their grave. So they would have been exhumed from French military burial sites to be brought in here after the war. On Memorial Day in 1921, four unknown soldiers were exhumed from here to become, one of them, to become America's unknown warrior. America was another nation that chose to do this after the Great War, with Britain and France having done this previously. The coffins were then brought to Châlons-en-Champagne, where Edward F. Younger, a decorated and wounded combat veteran, chose the third coffin of the fourth to be the one to be taken back to America. That unknown warrior was then taken to America on USS Olympia and buried with honour in the tomb of the unknown soldier at Arlington Cemetery. The other three who were not selected were brought here for burial and are buried side by side. Again, when we did the story of the last day of World War One, the superintendent of the cemetery told us this story, one that I'd not read before, and showed us where these three graves are. They're in the kind of right-hand side of the cemetery as you come up the main central aisle. There's nothing in front of them to say that who they are, that they were three of those four that were selected, which I kind of think is a bit of a shame in some respects, but it's an important story behind that tomb of the unknown soldier who lies buried and is so honoured in Arlington even to this day. Now, one rare, possibly unique aspect of the burials in this cemetery, rare and unique in the context of other American cemeteries, is that there are three infants buried here, children. From town hall records that exist in Romania, the nearby village, there was one stillborn baby of an American chauffeur who worked in the cemetery in 1921 buried here. One child who was buried was the son of an American army captain who was stationed in Germany in 1922, and when they moved those American burials from Germany to this cemetery after the war, that was one that was brought here too. And the third infant, the third child, was the son of the cemetery guardian who was here in 1920. And those children are buried in Plot F, Row 1, Graves 16, 29 and 31. So these are nothing to do with American servicemen. They are connected to American servicemen or the staff of the cemetery, and then uniquely, interestingly, buried here. There is quite a lot of mystery as to why that was allowed and why those graves remained here and were not repatriated back to the United States, because presumably their parents did return to America after the war. So, as often with this kind of research, as much as you find, it always poses more questions. But when you walk through this cemetery and you are surrounded by these thousands and thousands of crosses and stars of David, of Jewish American servicemen. In certain units, there was a very high proportion of Jewish Americans. We can sense the kind of scale, as I've said, the scale of sacrifice that America had in these battles, these final battles on the Western Front. And in many respects, it kind of brings on a sadness, the kind of sadness that we feel every time we see these young men cut off in their prime, lives unfulfilled, but also a sadness in that there are very few American visitors to this cemetery. Omaha Beach, the Normandy American cemetery there, has more than 1 million visitors a year, a very high proportion of which are American citizens. This cemetery has just a handful of American visitors every year, probably in the hundreds, not even in the thousands. There are groups that come here. There are more kind of battlefield tour groups coming from America. Mike Cunha, who we've spoken to several times on the podcast, he brings groups from America. And if you want to book a tour from America, seek Mike out and look into that. But there's nowhere near the level of visitors to this site. It is the largest US war cemetery in Europe. Most people think that is the one at Omaha Beach. It isn't. That's just under 10,000 burials. This one, as we've discussed, is over 14,000. But very few Americans come here. It is a long way from Paris. It's not easy to get to by public transport. I get all that. But it's an important chapter in America's history. But yeah, I think that kind of typifies the fate of that generation of the Great War, who are almost forgotten in America. Yet when you travel around America, every town, many villages, all the cities have Great War memorials in them. But those men, that generation of men that fought in the Great War, died with the American Expeditionary Force, are not remembered really in the same way that the men from Britain and the Commonwealth and from France are remembered. And that is something that I really hope will change in future years. These American servicemen, America's contribution to the Great War, needs to be remembered. It should not be forgotten. And over the years of coming here, I've probably brought more British visitors to this cemetery than Americans have travelled in the same kind of period, which is sad. I wish that was not true, because this generation, the deeds of these men who and women who are buried here, they must be remembered, and their place in American history needs to be properly secured, in my view. And the importance of that, I think, is never more present than when you stand in this cemetery and you see the scale of it. It's almost beyond imagination when you see those lines of symmetrically placed crosses disappearing into infinity. It's an experience that will change you. You'll never really, I think, be the same again after you've come to this cemetery. It's the same as visiting Tyne Cot or Langemarck or Menin for the Germans, or Notre Dame de Lorette for the French, or the Ossuary at Douaumont. It's the same kind of experience. It will change you forever. And it needs to be visited if you've never travelled to this part of the Western Front, this part of the old front line. So we'll bid our farewell to the doughboys that are buried here, and we'll head out through one of those enormous, impressive entrances and go out of the cemetery down into the neighbouring village of Romagna. The village of Romagna sat in the path of the American advance in the autumn of 1918. This too is a battlefield where American soldiers had fought. Prior to that, it was a village behind the German lines. There is quite a large German cemetery on the far side of Romagna, with graves dating right back to the early years of the Great War. And this was part of their rear echelon. German soldiers would have been billeted in this area during the fighting in the Argonne in the early phase of the conflict. But it became a battlefield when the Americans fought their way through here, and the village was very badly damaged as a consequence. Most of its buildings rebuilt, but again, you can see some kind of original features on some of them, so it wasn't entirely razed to the ground in the same way that some villages in this area was. But it's a very sleepy, quiet village. A lot of these rural locations in this part of France seem pretty much deserted, and many of them have a very high Dutch population of people that have second homes here. And that brings us to a very special individual that lives in this village, someone that I've known for a number of years, who I met during the filming that we did for The Last Day of World War One, and who runs one of the most impressive private museums of the Great War, Romagna 1418, Romagna 1418. And that's Jean-Paul de Vries. Jean-Paul is a lifelong Great War collector. He's half Dutch, half French, and he's lived here for many, many years, and he's tramped these battlefields. He knows them like no other person that I've ever met. And he showed us some amazing positions in the forests here, with bunkers and deep German trench lines, the Krimhilde line, for example. And his knowledge really is unsurpassed in that respect. And during his travels, getting to know the people within his area, he's been given a lot of material, he's found a lot of material, and this museum has something like 30,000 objects from the Great War. It's not just a big pile of junk. You go in there and it's themed, but there's all kinds of things on display, from weaponry to personal equipment. He's found the rubbish tip of the cemetery, so when they were burning the original crosses of men that were repatriated, the metal strips that had their details on, similar to the ones used by the Imperial War Graves Commission, he's found a lot of those. He's found insignia and buttons and all kinds of things in that area. So it's a lot of personal gear as well as official military equipment as well. And he's a great kind of advocate of remembrance and the role of American troops being remembered in the Great War. And he'll kind of give you a little guided tour of the museum when you go there. It's a great place to visit. And I went back there for the first time since COVID this year on a Ledger Battlefield tour. It was great to see Jean-Paul. He very kindly welcomed me like an old friend, and we had a great time with our group there who were really impressed with him, and he gave a really good talk to them. And I'm going to speak to him properly on a return visit for a separate podcast about what he's done and what his collection and what his museum is all about, so we can kind of return to that anon. But it ties in really to not just the history of the cemetery that we've just come to, but I think the wider fact here. We're coming into a quiet corner of the old front line here, a quiet corner of these battlefields of the Great War. But yet there is this museum with tens of thousands of objects connected to the fighting, from the Germans who were defending this ground and from the Americans who were attacking over it. And I think that is kind of the importance of places like this. They focus us on the history. They bring us to the tactile objects that connect us to the past. And they tell us the stories that are sometimes forgotten. And that word is so overused, really, in the context of military history. So many books claim to be telling the forgotten story. But there are some stories, for sure, that are neglected. And we just come from the largest American cemetery, military cemetery in Europe, with so few American visitors. And yet here we've got this incredible story of these men and these objects and the history that binds them all together. It's as if you step back into the Great War, really, when you go into museums like this. And these private museums, which are sadly declining, are so important in our understanding of these battlefields. So when we walk this ground and we think about the past and we pause and remember those whose names we've seen as we've scanned our way across those endless, endless lines of crosses in the cemetery, the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, this is an important part of one nation's story, an essential part of all of our understanding of the Great War. And when you're looking through the objects in this museum, Springfield rifles with bayonets fixed, cocked, ready to fire, who dropped that as they were going over the top? Mess tins with soldiers' names on, places in America, the badges, the buttons, the German helmets, everything that connects us to the men of both sides of no man's land who were at the very heart of this story of the Meuse-Argonne in 1918. This is where the pages of history keep turning, where our understanding of what happened in the Great War deepens, and through it we find the pathways that brought millions of American soldiers from all over its states to fight, to serve, and many to die here across America's old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.